journeying through the heart of deep Mexico.
Mexico is also a great country to visit for the tourist. It has beaches. You can sit on the beach and someone will bring you a mojito and a taco and you'll have a lovely time. But I wasn't there as a tourist. I wasn't there to have a brilliant, easy holiday. I was there to drive around in my own car on back roads and find out what Mexico Profundo, deep Mexico, was really like. And I felt I made some progress in that.
That's legendary writer Paul Theroux talking about his latest book, On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. We spend the hour with Theroux talking about Mexico from the U.S. border to the jungles of Chiapas, the resilience of a people in the face of violence and bad government, the preservation of ancient traditions by the poorest communities, and the inspiring rebellion in the south by the Zapatistas, who have created their own liberated territory. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Please make sure to like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whichever podcast app you use. After a lifetime spent crisscrossing the globe, travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux, author of The Mosquito Coast and The Great Railway Bazaar, explores a country close to home, Mexico, in his latest book, On the Plain of Snakes. First, he drives the entire length of the U.S.-Mexico border, reporting his encounters there with border crossers, border patrol officers, and humanitarian aid workers. Then, on to Mexico City, where he's mugged by a series of policemen demanding bribes, but also makes deep friendships through a class he teaches. Theroux then goes deep into the hinterland, on the back roads of Chiapas and Oaxaca, to uncover the rich, layered world behind today's brutal headlines. He meets with the legendary Subcomandante Marcos, leader of the Zapatista movement dedicated to defending the rights of Mexico's indigenous people. On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey is replete with adventures, history, discursions on literature, stunning description, and, running through it all, a deep humanity and respect for the ordinary Mexicans who are his main subject. On the Plain of Snakes uncovers the adventures of a man who, in his late 70s, still has the curiosity and guts to become transformed by the places and people he meets. What he discovers opens his eyes and changes his perspective. It may change yours as well. Paul Theroux has been called the world's most perceptive travel writer. He's the author of many highly acclaimed works of fiction and nonfiction, including The Great Railway Bazaar, The Mosquito Coast, and Riding the Iron Rooster. We spoke with him last about his book, Deep South. Paul Theroux, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
This book is just absolutely, I think, one of my favorites of your books. It's really terrific, On the Plain of Snakes and A Mexican Journey. The title is a metaphor for your journey through Mexico, from the border all the way down to Chiapas in the south. Why is the Plain of Snakes a metaphor for this journey?
The Plain of Snakes is the translation of a place name in Oaxaca. The name, which is a Zapotec word, Coaxtli Huaca, was spoken by a man I met near that town, or village, really. I said, "What does this mean?" He said, "Llano de los Serpientes." And I said, "On the Plain of Snakes, that's there's my title." That's because there are so many snakes in Mexico. There's a snake on the national flag, many, many towns have snake in the name. The snake is a kind of mystical creature. You may recall there's a book by D.H. Lawrence called The Plumed Serpent, which is a snake with feathers. And I came across one in a village with the snake with a flower on its head. So snakes come in all shapes and sizes. Some are benign, some are poisonous, and there's many in Mexico. And I came across a couple, too, in my travels. I thought this is the perfect metaphor for Mexico, which is the snake, which is sometimes poisonous, sometimes deadly, sometimes your friend, you know, or harmless anyway, decorative. And that was my experience of Mexico.
And you were warned by many people, both in the U.S. and in Mexico, not to make the journey. Don't go there. And when you started out, you seemed to be in a state of innocence in a way. But the dangers were real. And you had a really terrifying run-in with one Mexican policeman, for example.
The only problems in Mexico that I had were with policemen, strangely enough. Oh, maybe not so strange, because the police are, they also come in all, you know, like the plane of snakes. There are policemen who are very helpful and nice and others who are diabolical. My problem was that I was driving a car. You know, this is a road trip. So I drove from my home in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, to the border, then up and down the border, and then deeper into Mexico, really to Chiapas. But it wasn't when I got to Mexico City, I met the diabolical policeman. I had a car with Massachusetts license plates, and that to them is like catnip. They see a foreign plate, they say it's a gringo. The car was not very noticeable. I bought it particularly because it was sort of anonymous, inconspicuous. It was a Nissan Murano, used one, 2011. Nice car, though. I mean, all-wheel drive. But with these foreign plates, I was pulled over three times, actually. The first time was the scariest because it was my first experience of the predatory, opportunistic policeman in Mexico. And I had the experience of being screamed at, threatened, and then a bribe demanded. And the bribe was, he said, I want 300. Well, I had 300 pesos. So I said, here you are. And he said, no, I want $300 from you. So that turned it, and then I said, I don't have it. I'm old. I'm a pensionado. I'm retired. He said, go to an ATM. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm retired. I don't have money in the ATM. And this turned into quite a saga. I mean, it was much longer than it should have been. In the States, where I've had runs with the police, it's usually pretty brief. But this went on for quite a while because I had to stick to my story. Finally, he said, open your wallet. Abierta, he said, open your wallet. And I opened it, and he took everything in it. It was about $200. But the next time it happened, the man wanted $250. So I realized that the Mexican police are not totally reliable. And when a policeman is screaming at you and he's got a gun, there's really not a lot you can do. That was the only glitch that I had. I was not threatened by the cartels. I was not robbed by, you know, thugs or anything like that. I had a great time, a really wonderful time, and a very enlightening experience all the way through.
Yet the violence, of course, is terrifying, not so much for gringos maybe, although there have been problems. Gringos have certainly experienced problems that way, but for Mexicans, the violence is pretty terrific. And as you say, you had problems with police. You really draw the connection between the police, the gangs, and the whole economy of Mexico. You quote someone who says there's no business without terror. And so you really link this kind of business from the most illegal to the highest reaches of government. And I wonder if you could talk about that as a kind of ecosystem.
Yes, there's corruption everywhere. But I may say, on my way to Mexico, I went through Texas and I was caught in a speeding trap and a policeman said, you were speeding, you were doing 70. I said, I wasn't. And that was opportunism by, you know, Texas Ranger. But there you go. actually, it wasn't a Texas Ranger. It was a local policeman in Falfurrias, Texas. So it happens everywhere. But in Mexico, there's a culture of if you want something done, you're going to have to pay for it to be done. And it's, I would say, the first surprise I got, but maybe it wasn't a surprise, was to see that the border is owned by the cartels. That the cartels control the entrances to the United States, the main entrances, which they call plazas. Plaza is, means turf. It's the area where they're shipping the drugs. So you really can't move people or drugs or cargo, I would say, through the border, across the border, without paying some sort of fee to the cartels. They're pretty much like the mafia in New York City or Chicago or name a city where they owned people and businesses could not operate without them. I mean, this is still the case in some American cities where the mafia is strong. So the cartels, which are called the mafia by local people, they don't say the carteles, they say mafia, and they usually whisper it. So the people smuggling, a lot of the human trafficking on the border, I would say most of it, except for the individual who's walking across the desert, is controlled by the cartels, who get anywhere from, say, $2,000 to $6,000 to $30,000 from foreigners, I mean Chinese or Indians, who pay them big money to get them across. And in the No Business Without Terror is a line by John Gibler, who wrote about the cartels. And he said, if you want to start a business or you have something happening, maybe a great hotel or whatever, a great location, there's a protection racket that springs up. And I won't say this is universal in Mexico, but certainly it's quite common to be extorted by a cartel if you want to go on doing business. The main business of cartels are drugs, and the drug business is $100 billion a year. That's a RAND survey. $100 billion is a lot of money. So there's a lot of profit in it for a cartel, and this is why they use migrants to carry drugs across. It's why they have the crossing points, the plazas, controlled by them. And it's very difficult for anyone in Mexico to do a business, I would say, you know, say a really going concern. You could have a stall selling pineapples, or you maybe have a small shop. But I think as soon as your business looks like it's gaining ground, and particularly if it's in a mafia-controlled area, and there are very specific areas where the cartels are strong, you probably have to pay bribes to them, or you know, or pay them off. And the penalty for not cooperating is death. And beyond that, torture, dismemberment. So it's a very real problem. I must say I didn't encounter it except in secondhand ways. I saw the results of it, but I never encountered a cartel member who stopped my car or who extorted me. My problems were always with the police. But I should say that there are lots of police forces in Mexico which have been infiltrated by the police, or where there are cartel members on the police force. I mean, that's a proven fact.
If you're just joining Writer's Voice, we're talking with a great travel writer and novelist, Paul Theroux, about his latest book, On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. Yes, and lest we, you know, fall into the fictions of Donald Trump, I mean, we don't want to make it seem as if all you write about is the violence in Mexico, but what you do write is of a people who are really subjected and have been subjected for many, many decades, maybe even centuries, to what they call mal gobierno, you know, bad government. And this is really what we're talking about is corruption. You know, you have so much respect for the people that you meet on the way. In most cases, these are people who are poor and who are the victims of this kind of government, and yet they have tremendous dignity and resiliency as well. So I wonder if you could talk about, you know, what it's like to live as an ordinary Mexican in Mexico, what kinds of ways in which they deal with this kind of government, this kind of situation.
Well, that's the issue, is that when you have bad government, you need a backup, and the backup is friends and family. So the family is very, very strong. If you're looking for bad government makes people resourceful, so they have to look after themselves. There are no big pension schemes. I mean, the government doesn't help ordinary citizens. So people don't get, they don't retire with a pension. There's no national pension. Hospitals and clinics are very thin on the ground. It's also the reason why there are migrants. There are migrants who come to the States to earn money to send it back. They're not looking for welfare. I mean, the idea that Mexicans are parasites on the American system is very far from the truth. They tend to be very, very hardworking people. It's not like Central Americans are fleeing torture and violence. Mexicans tend not to be. Mexicans are fleeing poverty. The Central American who's fleeing torture and violence or gangs comes to the States, wants to stay in the States, and ultimately get a job. My feeling about the Mexicans was that typically it's a woman or a man who has no money, lives in a poor village, has a family, leaves, and then has a friend somewhere in California working in the fields, or in New England working in a factory, or in Florida doing the same thing. And they go to where they hear there's work, and they send it back. This is the effect of bad government. In the past, it's made people rebellious in Mexico, and there are still lots of strikes and reactions, demonstrations against the government for more pay, teachers in particular. But bad government in Mexico means that people, as I say, have to be resourceful, and resourceful means you either have a strike, you depend on yourself, you say the government is bad, I can't depend on them, or you say I'm going to go and cross the border, or go to the border and work in a factory. The factory is very poorly paid, but Mexicans, one of the possibilities that they have for working in a NAFTA factory, let's say, or they cross. In the past, it was very common for Mexicans to come across, work, and then go back and forth. It happened for years and years and years, until 1994 when the border was tightened by Bill Clinton. But everyone, the cry of bad government is everywhere. And they have a new government now, and that one is proving to be generally a disappointment. People were hopeful that because the party had changed. But I will say, my book is about the people that you mentioned, which is ordinary Mexicans, people living in villages. I made a point of visiting the villages and towns of the people that I had met on the border. So I met from Tijuana to Matamoros, from 2,000 miles of the border. I kept meeting people, and I'd say, where do you come from? Where's your home? And in general, I mean, the majority of the people come from southern Mexico, which are the poorest part of Mexico, where the per capita income is the same as Kenya or Bangladesh. So I went to those villages just to find out who lives there. What's the problem? Is it just poverty? Do they have links with American towns or with the cartels? Why do people leave? I'm kind of curious in the world of why people leave a village or a town that their ancestors have lived in for hundreds of years. Why do they go now? So I realized that poverty is driving people to the border and across it to make money to send it back. In most cases, I found Mexicans are not intending to come to the States to take out citizenship. I mean, there may be middle-class Mexicans who do that, but the poorer Mexicans have family, and they can't take their family with them. So they come across, they work in a meat processing plant, let's say, in the Midwest, in Nebraska or Colorado, chopping up chickens and freezing them, whatever it is. I mean, it's very, very hard work, but they're willing to do it. Or they work in roofing or something like that. Or they work in a hotel. And they send money back, and they have to pay off the people who helped them across. Usually they pay a couple of $1,000s to someone to help them across, and then they pay that off, they save the money, they send it across. When they finally made enough, they go home back to their family. And I'm impressed by the diligence of people who do that. It's why they don't go go to the embassy to get a visa. These are, they see themselves as short-term migrants. Very different from Indians, Pakistanis, and Chinese who cross the border, and there are many of them, who are coming to the States to have a better life. They usually pay a lot of money to get across. And that's a different category of migrant. They're called special interest aliens, SIAs, and they that's a different class of migrant altogether. But I mean, my trip was, I seem to be saying bad government and migrants. That's one of the stories. But there's so much more to Mexico than that, which I discovered.
Yes, and there is so much more in this amazing book, a very beautifully written book as well, Paul Theroux, On the Plane of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. So let's talk about some of those other things. One of the things you said that I thought was so interesting is that places that are poor are the places that preserve the old ways. And, you know, before we began this interview, I told you I had lived, when I was very small, in Mexico. And I have many, many photographs of that time. So my image of Mexico, although I'm sure in most places it's quite changed, yet in some places that you talk about, for example in Oaxaca or in Chiapas, because people are so poor, they have preserved the old ways. I wonder if you could talk more about that.
I didn't originate the quotation, but an English writer called V.S. Pritchard said, "The past of a place survives in its poor." And I would say that's true. One of my previous books was Deep South, where I traveled around the southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas. And what I found were in the poorer communities, they were still playing the music, praying at the churches, doing the work that they had done for generations. And in the Delta, for example, which is very poor, the Mississippi Delta is really one of the most deprived places I've traveled in my life, from Natchez up to Memphis. It's extremely deprived. But the people are storytellers. There's still blues festivals. They still sing the blues, and they have reason to sing the blues. And the past is still very strong, not only with African Americans there, but the whites, too, talk about the Civil War. The past, the Civil War, is very, very strong in their minds. People in the North, where I come from, never think about it, although many fought and died there. So in Mexico, the past is, for example, you get to a place, say a small village in Oaxaca, where everyone speaks Zapotec. Well, Zapotec is the ancient language of Mexico, of that part of Mexico, Monte Alban. Thousands of years, people have been speaking Zapotec. So the idea that this is still spoken is a comment on the continuity of culture in places where the family is speaking Zapotec. They've been doing it for ages. It's still taught in schools, but schools aren't great. So it's spoken at home. It's spoken in schools because that's the language of the town, usually. And there are many, many villages and towns where Zapotec is spoken. But it's it wasn't a written language, but it expresses a lot of the culture in the way that language is culture. So there are certain aspects of language that can only express the aspects of that particular culture, the habit or the weather or whatever. So the festivals in Mexico, particularly around this time of year, around the 1st of November, the festivals are still very strong. In places where people are very wealthy, where they tend to reject the culture that they emerged from. And nouveau riche would be one way of putting it. But the other is they're transforming themselves into new people, into wealthy people. And they don't live in the village anymore. They leave, they live in Mexico City, or they've emigrated to Los Angeles, whatever it is, and they've lost all that. One of the great advantages of traveling in the places that I've been, in India and in China and Africa and South America and Mexico, is that I've traveled among poor people, and the poor retain culture in the way other people don't. So the upside of being poor, I suppose, is that you can retain your culture. This isn't always true. I mean, it's not true. There are plenty of poor people in the state of Maine, in Chicago, and, you know, all over the states who say, I'm poor, I have nothing. And they really do have. They've lost it. But in traditional cultures, where people come from, where they live generations, I would say, the folk cultures, as sociologists call them, this is true. And so it's why the vitality of Mexico is really amazing, in that they've retained this. The vitality, the color, and the habits, and the customs of their ancestors.
Yes, and as you point out, I mean, probably not the urban poor, but certainly the rural poor. And you mentioned the festivals, especially around this time of year. You describe a festival, the Days of the Dead, in Oaxaca. I was really struck by that because, first of all, I'd like you to talk about the roots that that has in pre-conquest Mexico, as well as perhaps in Christianity, which one can think about as also a kind of cult of death with a God who is crucified on the cross, but also how it has connected with very contemporary issues, because the festival, the Days of the Dead in Oaxaca, were also an opportunity for people to express their protest against the government. So I wonder if you could weave these different strands together for us.
Sure. You talk about Christianity, of course. It's a way of easing, promising an afterlife. I would say that all religion, Judaism, certainly Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, are all designed for the believer to have the hope and promise that there's something beyond the earth, that it's to reduce the fear of death and to believe in an afterlife. Ancestor worship has that. So that kind of belief, the only one that isn't, Buddhism isn't a religion, but it teaches you how to live. As far as, in terms of your question, which is that the pre-conquest Mexico gave, the cultures and belief of pre-conquest Mexico inform the present, not just the Days of the Dead, but everything, the imagery, the language. So much of Mexico is rooted in pre-conquest times. Now, assertively, that one of the great heroes of today Mexico is Cuauhtémoc. Cuauhtémoc was the last Aztec king, chief, or paramount chief. There's a statue of him in Mexico City, and many people, that name, Cuauhtémoc, it's a common name. So the reaching back to pre-conquest, or to the individuals of the conquest, he's one of them, informs present-day Mexican life. And so the language, I mean, the Spaniards had to learn to speak Zapotec. They had to translate their Bible into Zapotec and, you know, communicate with people in Zapotec in order to deal with them, to look for gold, which is what they wanted to do, or to tax people, or to get them to build churches. I mean, there are still many people in Mexico, particularly in southern Mexico, for whom Spanish is a second language, and Zapotec or Tzotzil. The Tzotzil people are in Chiapas, who speak Tzotzil in their village, and they speak Spanish the way I do, you know, not that well, but I mean, they can get by. The greatness of Mexico is that it still has links to its past. It still reveres its past. The veneration of its great past, the pre-colonial past, is still very strong. And it's why the ruins and the temples and the art, and the artifacts of it are celebrated.
But you also felt a particular connection to this. You say in the book, and maybe I'm assuming, but you say in the book, the cult of death was something that attracted you, that it vitalized you in Mexico. And I wanted to know, why was that?
To a Mexican, according to the literature, and the great interpreter of this is Octavio Paz in his book The Labyrinth of Solitude. He talks about death is a friend, death is a companion, death is with us. You live with death. Death is all around you. So instead of fleeing from it, you reverence it. You say, that skeleton, that represents who I will be. And the days of the dead are not just celebrating, they mock death. They say, you know, we're not afraid of you. We're not afraid of death. So people dance around with skeletons. I mean, that it's not, it's to conquer the fear of death. So it's not a religion. It's something present. Death is very strong. I mean, even if you look at the murder rate in Mexico, which is enormous, you know, just something like 22,000 would be an average in a year, over 20,000, twice as much as the United States, maybe three times that of the United States. The Mexicans make a point of not fearing it. And then there's a new phenomenon, or fairly new phenomenon, of Santa Muerte. Santa Muerte is holy death, and that's a cult, which has roots in vaguely in Christianity, in Aztec imagery, and then something innovative, which is holy death, the skeleton, a woman, is going to protect you. That holy death, this image which people pray to and they get relics from, and there are chapels up and down Mexico, is a figure that will accept anyone. The drug dealer, the prostitute, the criminal, the poor person, the hopeless person. Everyone is welcome in the Chapel of Holy Death. And that's one of the fastest growing cults in Mexico. There are many, you know, that welcome the poor and the dispossessed. But the Santa Muerte cult, Holy Death, is one of them. That's different from mocking death, from the days of the dead death. But it's all around. It's very interesting how Mexicans accept it, not fear, not like Europeans. I would say one of the reasons is that there's a wonderful story by Tolstoy called The Death of Ivan Illich, and Ivan Illich hates dying, but there's a man called Gerasim, a peasant boy, who helps him in his distress, in his dying. So the lawyer, Ivan Illich, is afraid of death. He rages against it. He's afraid. And Gerasim isn't. Gerasim accepts it as a process of life. And I think Gerasim represents the Mexican attitude, which is you can't fight it. And mainly because they have so little. I mean, if you have nothing, if you have no material possessions, or very, very few material possessions, just your family, you lament the loss of, you know, losing your family, but you're not clinging to material possessions. People with a lot of money find it hard to die because they can't take it with them. It might be one shape, but also their life is so comfortable. They have everything materially. They don't want to leave it behind. Well, Mexicans kind of accept the fact that they have so little, and so they accept death. And it's the reason why you see skulls and skeletons and icons of skeletal figures all over the place. It's in Mexican life, in Mexican art, in Mexican writing. It's all over. And I mean, it's very, very interesting. And it's instructive, too, because obviously that we have to learn how to die. And they know how to do it.
Paul Theroux. There's much more to our conversation about his new book, On the Plain of Snakes, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with the legendary travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux, the author of, among others, The Mosquito Coast and The Great Railway Bazaar. His wonderful new book, a personal favorite of mine, is On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. Before the break, Theroux was talking about the Mexican attitude towards death. Theroux is in his 70s, and age is a thread that runs through On the Plain of Snakes. I asked him about it. You start the book talking about feeling old, really, feeling kind of old and tired, and, well, the remedy for that is to take a journey. And you really were vitalized by this journey. You didn't so much find out how to be young, but maybe to understand the vitality that is inherent in old age as well?
What I learned was that I'm not old. In America, people make you feel old. So people were making me feel old. And it's one of the diabolical aspects of living in the United States, is that old people are disregarded, they're invisible, they're no good, they're not buying stuff. The market forces are not aimed at them. They don't buy music, they don't buy expensive things. They're kind of heading into, you know, shoring up their, keeping their resources. And so advertising is very rarely, except for medicine or, you know, old hair or healthcare, they're not part of it. You know, they're not going to movies the way young people are. They're not part of that 18 to 35 demographic. So you go into a doctor's office and the punk in the desk says, "Hi, Paul, have a seat. The doctor will be with you." And you say, "Do I know you? You know, I'm Mr. Theroux, actually. I have a doctorate. So why don't you call me doc?" It's you. You know, you're nothing. So people are making me feel old. And I went to Mexico, and I found that older people are respected. You're not made to feel old. You're made to feel respected, as though you have some kind of wisdom, even though you may not have it. Mm. But you have experiences that they don't have. I say to people, you know, I'm a traveler. So my first book was The Great Railway Bazaar. And that was it came out in the mid-70s, 75, actually. But I traveled a lot before then. And I often say to people, say, "Oh, you've been to amazing places." But I've been to Bhutan, I've been to Cartagena, I went on a safari. And I say, you know, good for you, that's great. But I've been to a place that you've never been. It's called the past. I've been to the past. And the past is another country. And I could tell you about that if you were willing to listen, but obviously not many people are very interested in that. But, you know, older people have experience that younger people don't have. I know. I realize I'm talking like an old fogey in Mexico. I felt respected. I was Don Pablo, and people listened to me. And as a writer, they weren't saying, "Well, you're an old writer, a white guy, and what good are you?" They felt I had a tale to tell. So I taught a class in Mexico City, and it was attended by some wonderful, wonderful writers, actually, men and women, older. The oldest one's probably in his 60s, I guess, a retired diplomat. But there were some younger people there, and they're respectful. So, you know, I feel young. I went for a bike ride yesterday. You know, I'm in Hawaii, and I go swimming. I feel fit as a fiddle. So travel has that ability to help you transform and to feel better about yourself often. Because you're among people, you're among cultures that are more respectful of the old, of older people. So I felt that at the end of the trip, I felt rejuvenated.
And I would have to say that probably most cultures honor their elders. We have a culture that disrespects the old. But I'd also like to move on because you had another kind of really vitalizing experience. The experience of going to meet the Zapatistas. This was a movement that was founded in a drive for justice for the indigenous peoples of Mexico. I remember when the first outward rebellion happened that had been prepared for 10 years in the jungle. Talk about your experience there. You went and visited a village, a liberated village, and you met Subcomandante Marcos. So for those of our listeners who don't know about the Zapatistas or Subcomandante Marcos, talk about this movement, talk about this man who really is a hero, and how this revitalized your whole sense of, you know, the meaning of this journey for you.
I had a wish list in Mexico, people that I wanted to meet, the painter Francisco Toledo. I wanted to visit the chapel of Santa Muerte, and various things that I really wanted to see and do. And one of them was to visit the Zapatistas, just a visit. But I had a friend, I made a Mexican friend, who said that he could introduce me to the Zapatistas. And he said, "Marcos is having an event." They called it just a conversatario. and would I speak at it? And I said yes. The Zapatistas emerged from the Lacandon jungle in Chiapas the day that NAFTA was announced, January 1st, 1994. They were against NAFTA, and anyone who knows what the effects of NAFTA would probably, unless you have a company making stuff with low-wage people, you would question NAFTA. The Zapatistas were, as you say, were defending the rights of indigenous people whose land was being taken away from them by the mal gobierno, by the bad government. They're called ejidos, communal land. And communal land was being used for logging or for mineral, looking for minerals. And it was people who had lived on it for thousands of years were told to move. And they resisted. And the Zapatistas went to these villages. They lived among the people initially for 10 years, learned the language, found out what the people wanted, and they defended them, and they still defend them. When they came and when Marcos read his proclamation, the Mexican government went to battle with him, went to war with them, actually, and in a number of battles that killed a lot of people. But the Zapatistas ultimately remained defiant, and there was just a suspension of hostilities. The Zapatistas now run clinics, schools, villages, and they're still defenders of the people there. Marcos is still in the jungle. I met him. I gave a talk. I was really impressed. Impressed that someone could be at it that long, you know, as an idealistic person, still wearing his mask. All these people wear masks. And I found them inspiring. And I met people there. People were older than me, who were still believers in that rebellion. It wasn't a revolution. It was a rebellion against the government. They didn't turn things upside down. They just defended, they're defending their land. And they have very interesting things to say about GMO crops. They also defend the rights of women very, very strongly. They have an office for the dignity of women. They defend the gay community. The gay community is under siege in lots of parts of Mexico. There's a lot of homophobia in Mexico, but not among the Zapatistas. They defend gay rights. So they're very impressive in every way, and they're in a place where people are very, very poor. I mean, people are so poor in Chiapas, they don't even think of migrating to the United States. They, you know, to them, the ultimate would be to get to Mexico City and get a job there, let's say. But it's a long, long way to the border. Although I did meet people from Chiapas on the border, I didn't meet many. But the Zapatistas was on my list. I wanted to meet them. It wasn't like the, you know, people say, well, they're like Che Guevara. And I say, no, they weren't. The Cuban Revolution was a very quick one. It wasn't as though Fidel Castro stayed in the mountains in Cuba and ingratiated himself with the peasants and stayed there for 10 years. In a matter of months, he swept into Havana and took over the country. So it's not like that. These are, as they say, con la paciencia de hormiga, with the patience of an ant. You need the patience of an ant to have a proper revolution or a proper rebellion, to understand people, just the way an ant is just moving slowly across the ground. So, you know, I was able to meet them, talk to them, and wrote about them, and that's how my book ends. Ends on a note of respect, admiration for what they're doing, and, you know, for idealistic people. And I realized very early in my life, I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I tried to help change things in Africa, not in a big way, but in a small way as a teacher in a school. And I realized that all my life I was trying to understand, what is the nature of poverty? How do you change things? How do you impress people? And you do it by inspiring them. And I felt in Africa, I do feel that people are not inspired. The Peace Corps goes, they teach, they leave, and then a new crop of teachers come in and they do things. But that's not a change. That's not inspiring people. But the Zapatistas were inspirational figures. And their villages are very, very impressive for the schools, which are very well run, and there's lots of them. They have sports, they play basketball, they have great clinics. It's a true democracy. They have town meetings, village meetings, where they sit and they discuss issues, just the way they would where I'm, you know, I'm from a small town in Massachusetts where we have a town meeting. People go and they talk about the problems of the town. I mean, that's a kind of town democracy which you find among the Zapatistas. So all in all, I mean, that was, it gives a point to the book too. The book is not a random, went here, had a taco, went there, met this guy. It's a journey of to a kind of enlightenment, as I saw it, and to something which is not just a journey, but more than that, a place I'd like to go back to. And I've been back to Mexico 3 times since I finished the book. So that's proof that I'm not afraid of Mexico. I'm careful when I'm there. I never drove at night. When people said this place is dangerous, I avoided it. So the Zapatistas was the perfect ending to it, because it was a discovery that I made. And you can't travel unless you make discoveries. Every day matters when you're making a discovery. If you're a tourist and you're sitting on the beach, you're probably not making any discovery. But when you're traveling, when you're on the move, and there are hardships involved, you're probably making some kind of a discovery, which makes the travel worthwhile.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with the great travel writer and novelist, Paul Theroux, about his latest book, On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey. And you shared that discovery so much with the reader. I mean, one of the things that you say at the end about this, that the Zapatistas built their movement on everything humane and enduring in the traditions of the indigenous people. And those traditions of the indigenous people are, in fact, I mean, what I reflected, this is the way we need to live, not exactly, but with the same understanding and respect of our connection to the world and to each other. That's what seemed to me was the real lesson that you came away with.
Yes, definitely, and not only in Mexico, but I mean, when people talk about America, this is a land of migrants, we're a country of migrants. We're not a country of migrants, we're a country of indigenous people who've most have been exterminated. This is not our country. This country belonged to a number of peoples who lived in various parts, and my grandmother was one of them, my paternal grandmother, and it was the migrants who exterminated them. So we have to come to grips with that, and there's a reconciliation that still hasn't taken place, that you could go to the most salubrious parts of the United States and find indigenous people. You would find in Martha's Vineyard, where it's an island of millionaires and multimillionaires, there are indigenous people, the Wampanoag people. In Maine, wealthy people live on the coast of Maine, but so do indigenous people, the Abenaki people, the Penobscot people, and others. Upstate New York, the Onondaga people. In Wisconsin, the Menominee people.
And where I live, the Shinnecocks, the Shinnecock people, yes.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what I learned, I mean, but I didn't really need to be told this, but it's a reminder that of what we owe to the indigenous people and how their land has been taken away, or they've been cheated and used and killed. So that's a great, it's a revelation to most people, you know, this is a country of migrants. Well, yes, migrants built the government. It's not theirs. We're new arrivals to a place where the indigenous people have lived here for 6,000 years. So, you know, that's something that we need to reckon with. And whenever people talk about it's a country of migrants, I know it's a country of migrants. I know that. But it's fundamentally, the United States is a country which was of indigenous people who didn't talk about ownership of the land. They didn't feel, they felt that that the land was given to them by the Great Spirit, and they shared it in general. So it wasn't something to sell. It was the pilgrims, among others, who sold them guns and beads and whatever, and taught them what the market economy might do for them. And, I mean, that's true. I mean, Hawaii, it happened here. It's happened in Mexico. The Zapatistas, they're the chroniclers of this series of events, and they're defenders of the people and preservers of great cultures. So that's another lesson in Mexico. Mexico is also a great country to visit for the tourist. It has beaches. You can sit on the beach and someone will bring you a mojito and a taco and you'll have a lovely time. But I wasn't there as a tourist. I wasn't there to have a brilliant, easy holiday. I was there to drive around in my own car on back roads and find out what Mexico Profundo, deep Mexico, was really like. And I felt I made some progress in that.
Well, it is a terrific book. One of my favorites, I have to say. Paul Theroux, it has been just a real privilege to talk with you again. I look forward, perhaps your next book might be The Deep Indian Country in the U.S.
I'd love to. It's been written about very ably by better people than me, but I had the idea of traveling from one Indian reservation to another. I mean, the border, for example, the Tohono O'odham people are in Arizona and Mexico. The border runs right through their land. And in Gila Bed in southern Arizona, there are people who still speak the language, and, you know, there's a reservation there. So it's, you know, it doesn't respect, the borders of countries run across these tribal lands. But I thought of doing that. I don't know whether that will be it or whether, you know, if I'm spared, I don't know what my trip will be. But I'm still able and willing and eager to travel. My next book will be a novel, which I'm working on now. But after that, I will take a trip, and I'll let you know in advance what it might be.
Well, do, and I'd love to talk with you about your novel as well. Well, again, Paul Theroux, thank you so much for talking with us here on
Writer's Voice. It's been a pleasure.
Paul Theroux. You can read an excerpt from On the Plane of Snakes with photos that was published by the New York Times. Find the link at writersvoice.net. We have a little time left. A little time in which to read a poem by the Mexican poet Javier Sicilia. This is What is Open, translated from the Spanish by David Shook. What is open? To us who walk upright, as if the fate of our condition would be covered by that gesture, not the animal that advances low to the ground toward what is open, a backwards and forwards in the happening of the infinite, not the tree that rooted, its mouth within the earth, its sex against the wind, inhabits a pure space of your immobility, not the angel, too perfect in its beauty, an essence made of space, bird of light, suspended in the eternal, but we who advance gropingly between heaven and earth, terrified of death, hollowed with holes. To us, viatores, who yearn for both the earth and the heavenly, and aren't at peace with ourselves. Only love saves us from our anxious flight forward, as if in the contours of what is loved, what is open would close, and the hollowness of flesh would find repose in what is created, and would not see its death, but rather a proclaimed beyond, contained within the limits of the body. Lovers know it, those so close to one another, who look amazed into the openness that their eyes discover in their eyes. But neither one or the other cross into it, and they return to the world. Could it perhaps be the fear of the infinite call, or the sweet nostalgia of forever residing in what is created that never restrains them? Or maybe that is our place, the spot of the eternal that corresponds us, to contemplate and feel the infinite wrapped in the flesh, in that mutual giving of one to the other, while the slow flight toward what is open allows us to inhabit the duration, that already, but not yet, that the lovers live at grazing skin, that eternal presence that makes us present in ungraspable time, like a tenuous crack in the porcelain alb of the open. That was What is Open by the Mexican poet Javier Sicilia, translated by David Shook. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.